The following lecture, titled Islam and the Black Movement, was recorded May 18, 1995, at Morgan Park High School in Chicago, Illinois.
Good morning. Good morning to our principal, Mr. Alexander, teachers, students, and guests.
Our guest for today, Waladin Muhammad, was born October 30th, 1933, to the parents of Elijah and Claire Muhammad.
W.D. Muhammad succeeded his father as leader of the American Muslims on February 26, 1975.
The past February marks 20 years of his leadership.
He has received numerous awards, honors, and proclamations for his religious and humanitarian work.
He has authored many publications such as A Prayer and El Islam, focus on El Islam unity and leadership.
His official title describes him perfectly.
Muslim American spokesman for human salvation.
Please join us in welcoming our grandfather, W.D. Muhammad.
Peace be on you. Good morning. I don't usually get nervous nowadays. When I started out, it was a long time ago, I was so nervous I couldn't even speak when I looked at the audience. But somehow I got started. It's a very special school, and you're very special students here at Morgan High. I am the son of a man who excited a lot of people. He even made a lot of people afraid. Elijah Muhammad, I know some of you know about him. And we were called Black Muslims by Dr. C. Eric Lincoln, who wrote the book Black Muslims. He introduced us to a wide readership in America. And we were also called the Nation of Islam, the Nation of Islam in America. We hope that you will understand who the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was and what the Nation of Islam is, was, and is, and maybe some other things, too, that you might want to have a better understanding of regarding the Muslims in America. First of all, I hope that you will understand what the religion of the Muslims is. We appreciate the opportunity to speak to you here. We'd like to thank all of you, the principal, Mr. Charles Alexander, and the Black History, African American History teacher, Mr. McGee, and my grandchildren, the Stein twins that we are proud of here at Morgan Park High. Tahir and Tahira. I would like to begin by saying that the Nation of Islam, the Black Muslims, whatever name you're called by, we didn't just pop up on our own. Some things were happening in America to influence the development or the creation of what is known as the Nation of Islam, are Black Muslims. And some of these things were, I would say, the main influence was a movement in African American people or Black people away from the white American authority. Many African Americans, especially in religion, have started to resent having so much white authority in their lives. And when they were saying white authority, they even meant Christianity, because there, some of them had come to believe that even Christianity was something that we came into that was not originally our own. And many thought that Christianity itself was a problem for Black authority. Black authority. Firstly, Black authority in our own life, in our own families, Black authorities in our communities. we wanted most of all, and I'm identifying with that movement because I was a child in the 30s when the Nation of Islam got started, and the Nation of Islam then really become popular in the public's eye until the 60s. And all those years, I was a child in the family of Lord Elijah Muhammad, the son of Elijah Muhammad, who actually built the Nation of Islam over a period of about 40 some years, of almost 50 years. And I was also a student in our school, private school, called at that time the University of Islam, but it was not a university, really. It was elementary school, and later on we had a high school, but it started out as elementary school. And it was called the university in hopes of inspiring us, pressuring us to want to have our own university. Now, the Nation of Islam wasn't the only effort by blacks like that. There were black colleges in the early days of black college history that didn't have really a college staff or professors with PhD degrees or doctorate degrees, PhD degrees or doctorate degrees. But those colleges was a brave effort by brave and determined African-American intellectuals, and they were intellectuals, to have image, presence, status, reputation for managing things themselves. So the first black colleges were not really properly staffed. Some of the professors did not have doctorate degrees. And the Nation of Islam, I think, its teacher, first teacher, a foreigner, not a black, the first teacher, a foreigner by the name of Farad, spelled F-A-R-D, he had a kind of spiritual science. And you students, some of you are sure, I'm sure, acquainted with the study of psychology, psychoanalysis, and maybe some of you might even be aware of business psychology. I strongly believe that psychoanalysis, business psychology, and some other branches of psychology evolved out of spiritual science, religious spiritual sciences. This man, Farad, was obviously a well-educated person in religious spiritual sciences. So he used psychology. And one evidence of the psychology he used is just that. He called an elementary school university. He called a group of men, really organized just like very much like Booker T. Washington's students were organized. Booker T. Washington, he organized his students under him, under black authority, to have vocational education and higher education. But he also included military drill. He had something looking much like maybe ROTC. He had military drill. And Booker T. Washington believed that physical discipline, an African-American or a black man saying, attention, at ease, giving commands, left face, right face, attention, matai march, and calling cadence, to the left, to the right, to the rear, march, calling cadence like that. Booker T. Washington believed that kind of discipline was needed to orientate, to get black students used to hearing a black man give an order and acting on it positively, responding to it, doing what he says without question, without hesitation. So he used the psychology himself, that psychology of military drill, to help instill disciplines in students for obedience to a black authority. That was Booker T. Washington. Farrar, clever man, very clever man, a foreigner. Some say he was from Arabia, an Arab. Some say he was Turkish, because the flag he gave us resembles the Turkish flag. But I'm convinced, after studying his handwriting, cards from him, and other things about him, I'm convinced that he was Indian from Asia, not American Indian, Far East Indian from Asia, and most likely from the country that is now called Pakistan. I do believe he came from that area. Now, I have about 40 minutes, so I don't want to waste too much time, but I want to give you a good picture. I'm speaking to students. I'm trying to tell you what you would appreciate. I don't talk like this to just any audience. I'm doing this for you. This is especially for you. I began by saying that the main thing we wanted, the main interest, was advancement. The NAACP has just that language in its name, advancement, advancement of the colored people, advancement. It was no different for the Nation of Islam, for black Muslims, or for Marcus Garvey, or for Father Divine, who had a big following, Christian preacher with a Christian church, big following of black people, African Americans, in Detroit, Michigan. And it was not Farrar, the teacher of the black Muslims, or the leader, the one who conceived the idea, who drew up the idea for the Nation of Islam, who introduced black people man as a God figure, as a God figure. It was Father Divine, a Christian. His name tells you that his followers regarded him as a divine man, Father Divine. He taught his followers this. He said, you will never see Christ, and we say peace. The Muslims have to say peace be upon Christ. Any prophet we mention, we have to say peace be upon him, peace be upon Jesus Christ. He said, you will never see him any better than you see him when you're looking at me. This is what Father Divine taught his people. He even ended up marrying a woman and calling her mother, like Mother Mary. So the followers saw his wife as Mother Mary and saw him as Christ, the second coming of Christ, or Christ in the world living. So he was really the first one that I know who pointed to black person and said that the black person is a God figure, a God. I know many of you are aware that the Nation of Islam has taught that God is a black man. You should be aware of that, if you're not. If you're not, I'm not sorry. But if you are, I understand, because it has been made very popular, that idea that God is a black man. Now, if I said God is a white man, would that disturb you all? If I say God is a white man, it should disturb you. God should not be any color man. God is God. God was before man, before all men. So it should disturb us if someone say God is a white man. And it should disturb us if someone says God is a black man. Now, Mike Wallace, when he introduced the black Muslims, or the African-American Muslims under the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's leadership, to the American people on 60 Minutes, primetime news, he said he introduced the Muslims as the hate that hate produced, the hate that hate produced. Well, I'm going to take off from what he said, the hate that hate produced, and he was correct. If black people have strong reasons to hate white people, then something has happened to make them feel that way. People don't just feel that way without something happening, something very seriously happening. And likewise, the black man would never say a black man is God unless he had had a problem with someone saying a white man is God. I think you can understand that. So whether these extremes were justified or not, are justifiable even now or not, we should try to understand what caused these extremes, what produced these extremes, what triggered these extremes. And it was extremes in our lives, African-American people lives, extremes of white image, white greatness, white authority, white dominance, white supremacy. It was extremes of that nature that triggered a desire in us to compete with the white man's claim to authority. So eventually you have a black man. If a white man says, this is God's only begotten, a white man, and give us that image on the cross, this is not at all criticism of Jesus. We believe in Jesus too. Muslims believe in Jesus. But we don't believe in image. We don't believe in image. We don't believe in that image of a man. We don't believe in that. Eventually you have a black man, some black leader, saying no. In fact, there's another reverend recently, who put a black figure on the cross and said, this is Jesus, in his church. Very popular preacher. He actually put the figure of a black man on the cross and told his people, this is Jesus, this is God, you see? And if Mike Wallace could say to America on 60 Minutes, the black Muslims do hate, but they are the hate that hate produced. And what he meant and clearly documented is that we had ourselves the need to feel that we were hated by white folks. And that's what triggered an extreme in us, a radical movement to tell the white man, yes, we hate you too. You're a race of devils. That's what Elijah Muhammad told the white man. You're a race of devils. Your father was a devil, father of the devil. He said, your father was the father of the devil, and you are a race of devils. And he told our people, he said, know them, they are a race of devils. Don't believe in them, don't follow their ways, but come to your own. And he was given something from Farrar that gave an identity. Now, I'm going to mention another man who wrote a book. He was African. He was a student from Africa who came to America to study the followers of Elijah Muhammad, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Black Muslim, Temple of Islam, Nation of Islam people. He came for the purpose of studying them to do his doctorate on the black Muslims. He wrote his book, and he said, after studying the following of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that more than anything else, the effort in the Nation of Islam was an effort to give a culture to black people. And he said that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had really been successful in creating a cultural identity to answer the need in the void of African-American psyche for a strong sense of identity as a people. And I believe that's what counts for, or that's what explains the devotion and obedience that we see in the followers of Farrakhan. You'll see them selling the newspapers, Final Call newspapers. And you see in them a strong obedience, a strong devotion to whatever it is they believe in. And I believe that accounts for it more than anything else. When they joined the Nation of Islam on the Farrakhan, it's just like it was I didn't join, I was born a baby to my mother at the time when my father and mother accepted the religion, so I was born Wallace D. Muhammad. Many blacks tell me, oh, you know your name, no Wallace D. You weren't named no Muhammad. But it's a fact, it's on my birth certificate. The FBI knows, they arrested me and they know everything about me. At least all the legal questions, they can answer all the legal questions. So I was named Wallace D. Muhammad by my father, who changed his name from Elijah Poole, P-O-O-L-E, to Muhammad, Elijah Muhammad. Upon Farrar advising him that he should take the name Muhammad. Farrar was, again, don't forget, he was a foreigner. He advised my father that he should take the name Muhammad. So on my birth certificate, my parents is Elijah Muhammad and Clara Evans. That's my mother's maiden name, Evans. Elijah Muhammad, and Clara Evans. I was born in Detroit, a little place called Hamtramck, Michigan. It's now part of Detroit. And my name is Wallace D. Muhammad on my birth certificate. That's the way it's been since 1933, October 30th, 1933. That's me. Now, getting back to the image, the need for an image of authority, an image of authority. When a new person joins the Temple of Islam, a Nation of Islam, right away he comes into an environment that's quite different. Never has he been in a different, or her, as she, been in an environment so different. He sees black people, black men, especially black men, even women too though, holding themselves very militant posture, keeping a very militant posture, and greeting each other with respect. And he'll see on the first time, most likely, you'll see men greeting, saluting each other as though they're in the army. Take your post, brother. Yeah. President accounted for. You'll see that, you know. You'll see all that. So it's a quite different environment, quite a different environment. And you'll hear that language that I've been introducing to you very slowly, that language that says, we do not recognize or accept or respect white authority over us. We accept nothing but black authority, our own authority. So in the Nation of Islam, religion is really a psychology. The religion itself that is called Islam in the Nation of Islam is a psychology. It's a psychology to take us away from, influence us away from seeing God in white image or in white flesh. It's a psychology to take us away from believing that revelation, scripture, holy books came from white angels or from white authority to our hands, into our hands. It's a psychology more than anything else. And the teacher who conceived, the first teacher who conceived this idea, put together this idea to change the psychology of inferiority and replace it with a psychology of superiority. See, that's what he did. And sometimes spiritual science, you may say psychology, spiritual science believes that you have to, if you have one extreme, to get rid of that extreme, you have to come with another extreme. And in creating extreme to bring a person from this extreme to that extreme, the belief is that extremes are not comfortable for human nature. No extreme is comfortable. No unnatural, I'm talking about unnatural extremes, mind you. No unnatural extreme is comfortable for real human nature. So if you can bring the person from one unnatural extreme, say to the left, extreme to the left, to another unnatural extreme, it's going counter that one. It's against the one that the person is under. Eventually, nature will bring the person to the meat, to the middle, where the person won't be of that extreme or that extreme. That was the science of Farad, and it worked for me. I was stressed out to that extreme here, to the negative extreme, saying everything in the white man's world is wrong. His religion is wrong. He's wrong. His system is wrong. Everything is wrong. He's a devil by nature. That's what I was taught as a baby and a young boy. That's all I knew. So here I am in this extreme. But now I grow up like you. I have a teenage mind now, and soon I'm having a young man's mind, and I'm exposed to the world. My father didn't keep me from learning Arabic language, the original text of our holy book, Quranic Arabic. I read it now for myself, which brought me more understanding than I was getting in the Nation of Islam. My father didn't keep me from going and studying sciences, subjects outside of the curriculum of our private school, the Temple of Islam. He didn't say, don't do that. So I did that. So eventually, I was not worldly naive like my father was when he met Farad. My father met Farrar in 1931, I believe, and he was really naive. He only had 3 years elementary schooling. He taught himself how to write, taught himself how to read, my father. He educated himself, just like Malcolm did. We're going to get to Malcolm later. Farrar could have told my father anything. He could have told my father that in Arabia, people lived in igloos. Now, you know it's too hot over there, but my father didn't know the climate. He didn't know the geography. He could have been told that, yeah, they live in igloos over there, like the Eskimos. My father wouldn't have known any different. He would have believed it. So he told my father things that were more metaphorical, if you understand the language metaphor. I'm sure some of you do. Metaphorical. It was more a symbol, a sign pointing to something else, something needing to be explained. Like we say in mathematics or in arithmetic, you have the figure 2, right? And you might be adding up something on your paper. You have 2 and 12, 14. And I'll look at that and I'll say, 2 and 12, 14. What are you doing? Just practicing arithmetic, addition? And you may say, no. I'm figuring out how much I owe or how many things that I have to deal with here. That 12 and 2, and you're adding up some things. So it may be 12 oranges. And it may be 2 apples. I don't know. So the 2 represents something else. The 2 is not something by itself. The 2 by itself is only a symbol representing something else. So Farrar put together a language very much like that. And when he said black, he didn't mean really black color. He meant black color in one language, which is a little important, but he meant black in another language, the language of science, spiritual science, which was the real importance. So when he said black, he was talking about something that was much more important than pigmentation in the skin. And when he said white, he was talking about something much more important than pigmentation in the skin. The white he was talking about in Scripture, Bible, is called the white of leprosy. So what he was saying is that the white man's spiritual makeup is diseased. His spiritual makeup, though he's conscious man, though he claims purity, he claims whiteness, but his whiteness is the whiteness of leprosy, a disease, a very bad skin disease. Some of you perhaps have heard it. This is in Scripture. Scripture says, of a certain people, says, and their whiteness is the whiteness of the lepers, the diseased people who have that bad disease skin. So, actually, if I could go back and get you some of the documents of Farrar himself, I could show you that he didn't really say white. He said so-called white at first. Then later they just said white. He said so-called white man. So that meant that he didn't regard him as really being white in the meaning that we find in the dictionary, under the meanings we find in the dictionary, white meaning pure and all that. So that's why he resented the white man should call himself white meaning pure. He said he's the so-called white man. He's a grafted devil, the skunk of the planet Earth. All those words are from Farrar, not from me. That's from a foreigner. This is what he called a white race. He said he's the so-called white man. He's a grafted devil, the skunk of the planet Earth. This is what he said. This helps you to understand how that nation of Islam is so magnetic in the poor part or poor sections of these cities where we live. How come it's so magnetic? How come it draws with such strong appeal, such strong magnetic appeal? Because of that kind of those teachings. Those words are very powerful magnetic pieces. They will attract our mind, it will attract our interest. And before we know it, we're listening to everything the preacher is saying or the minister of Islam is saying, and we are not questioning anything he's saying. Our mind just submits to him. And that's what happens to many young men, African-American men like you, and to many African-American young women like you in this audience here at Morgan Park. And don't think it's always the uneducated that is attracted to this kind of teachings. Nowadays, we find professors on these campuses being attracted to the teachings of the Nation of Islam. So its appeal now has even gone into the college-minded student or person, even the professors, even a good number, a significant number of those who have PhDs are in the following of the movement we call the Nation of Islam. Now, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I believe he was very much aware that Farad was saying two things with this language. He was saying something to the ordinary mind, and he was saying something else to the mind of those who would study sciences, spiritual sciences, Farad's spiritual sciences, and come up with answers so they can understand his language. So he's saying something to the uneducated in his following, and he's saying something else to the educated in his following. Not educated in the sense that you understand educated, or that we normally would understand educated. Educated in the sense that they have studied and understood much of his science. Science of language, science of spiritual science, and science of language. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I repeat, I believe that he understood much of that. So he had a strategy too. Farad, his mystical teacher, had a strategy, and Elijah Muhammad had a strategy. His strategy was first to attract blacks with the religious teachings of Farad. That was a psychology more than a religion. And after he got enough following to support him, then he was to move emphasis from religion and studying religion, that religion of Farad, to business development. So that's exactly what he did. His leadership began as an independent authority over us and around 1936. And he continued with that religious emphasis on religion until about 1949. It really became very much obvious that the emphasis was changed from spiritual sciences or religion to business development in about 1955. That was also around the time that Malcolm got acquainted with the Temple of Islam, with Elijah Muhammad and the Temple of Islam, the Nation of Islam, and decided that he wanted to become a follower or a member. The young Malcolm joined the Nation of Islam, all excited. I've never seen any minister of my father more excited, more enthused, more anxious to just get started, to do things. And I remember the first time I met him, tall, reddish complexion man, warm smile, piercing eyes, excited eyes. He looked at me and he said, "You're Wallace," as if he was telling me who I was. "You're Wallace." I said, "Yes." He said, "You're the son of the messenger. You're the son of our Elijah Muhammad." I said, "Yes." And then he began to work on me. He didn't care who you were. He wanted to recruit young men for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to build the Nation of Islam. That's what he wanted. So right away he took to me and he asked my father, he said, "Sometimes when I want to know certain questions on religion, say, can I talk to your son Wallace?" And he told me, "Your father said, yes," said, "that's what I would like to see you do." He said, "I would like to see you and Wallace become close." And that's what happened. We did become close. I was a student in religion. I was a student also of Quranic Arabic. Quran is our holy book. Quranic Arabic is the Arabic in our book, the Arabic grammar and everything set by our holy book. So I was a student of that. Malcolm knew it, and he was new and fresh in the Nation of Islam. So he wanted to be with someone that he felt comfortable with. And I guess he said, well, no one I would feel more comfortable with than a minister who was also raised in the house of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad by Sister Clara Muhammad. That's my mother, Clara. So we got to discussing some of the teachings once. and Malcolm. I think this will help you understand Malcolm too. Malcolm said, Wallace, he said, I'm going to be honest with you. He said, some of these things in the teachings, in the religious teachings, I can't handle it. So I want your father to free me so I can go out there and talk what I know I can talk. I want him to free me so I can go out there and challenge that white man and challenge, he called the leadership at that time of our people, Uncle Tom leadership, and challenge this Uncle Tom leadership. He said, I can do it if I don't have to deal with a lot of this religious language that honestly I can't understand. So Malcolm being new and coming at a time when the religious emphasis, when the emphasis were taken off of the religion, the mystical religion, and put on practical things, having businesses of your own, employing your own people, changing your community from one of material neglect or blighted areas to thriving, beautiful neighborhoods. That was the ambition. That was the aspiration of the Nation of Islam. To do the same thing, all black leaders who assumed authority and independence in white America, to better our people, to make us more progressive, or to see more advancement in the African American person and in the African American community. So soon, Malcolm was putting his emphasis on those things. Here was his message. It was powerful. His message was this. He would tell his audience when he first started out. Malcolm would say to the audience, you are living under Pharaoh. Say, Pharaoh is not back there in Egypt. Say, Pharaoh is here now. So you're living under Pharaoh. He says, and you are the enslaved Hebrews. Say, you are the enslaved Hebrews. That's what Malcolm would tell his audience. And he would say, and it is the God of Moses that have sent Moses to deliver you. Says, and your Moses is that little black man, Elijah Muhammad. That's the way he would tell you. He would introduce the message that way. And he would say, brother, how come you don't have a job? And then he would come and introduce the business plan to provide jobs for black people. And now we're going to break for a little while here and hope we can accept questions from you later.
Okay.
I have a few more, just a few more short statements before they ask questions. But we will say that this is concluded and my statements will be given in the question and answer period.
I would like to finish my comments on Malcolm. I think it's very important. And I know, Malcolm became perhaps the most popular figure in the history of the Muslims in America, the black Muslims in America, African American Muslims, because he was aggressive, assertive, self-assertive. He asserted himself, pushed forward. He was like what you would call a workaholic. From the time he got up, the time he went to bed, he was busy just working. And he was a very excellent speaker, especially when it came to arguments. He was sharp. He could debate. He was a very sharp person when it came to debating and defending the positions that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam took. So because Malcolm was so articulate, he very soon became the most popular minister in the Nation of Islam, even more popular than Elijah Muhammad, his teacher. And believe me, a friendship was formed for Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm that was even more than a friendship. It was like a father and son relationship. My mother saw it that way, and she would tell Malcolm sometimes, she said, I want you to know, you're just like my own son. And she would call him son. She would call Malcolm son. There were a few other ministers that I think she occasionally would call son, because my mother was just like that. She was typical of a church woman who was the wife of the minister, you know, and she would give the religion and the church and the
the leader all the support, and even sometimes more support than he would ask for. So she would want to strengthen all the ministers. I heard her call Farrakhan my son once. Farrakhan, she said to him, but it was not a normal or usual expression of hers when she was talking to Farrakhan or some others. But with Malcolm, it was always, whenever she saw him, she said, "My son, how are you? How are you doing?" And that's how the conversation would begin, after giving him salam alaikum, the greetings, peace be on you, or peace be unto you. Because Malcolm was so articulate and he studied, he told me, he said, "Wallace," he said, "I had done 8 years of a 14-year sentence in jail." He was sentenced to stay in jail for 14 years, I believe. That was the sentence. And he actually did stay in jail for 8 years. He said, during those 8 years, he said, "I read dictionary definition for definition from A to Z." He said, "And I got a book called Theosaurus." I forget, Roger's Theosaurus, I think, was the name of the book. It's a Theosaurus that give you meanings, many meanings, all the meanings. It tries to give you all the meanings that that particular word has under its entry. So under the entry, whatever the word is, will come all the meanings, even though those meanings be distant from the literal or first meaning. They will give you all those meanings, no matter how weak those meanings are in their relationship to that word that you find in the entry in the dictionary. So he said, "I studied the Theosaurus." That's the Theosaurus. By the way, he also told me he studied communism, and was considering becoming a communist while he was in prison. But he had a terrific vocabulary, so he could just debate and pull the word out and serve the word, would serve the purpose. And most of his opponents, they would look like they were the weaker in the argument, even though they might have been standing upon more rational grounds than Malcolm was standing upon. And you know, a person with sharp wits, they can defend an untruth and make your truth look like your truth is false. Some people have that skill. You know, I ran into them. Not that what Malcolm was presenting was false in its entirety. No. What Malcolm was presenting on the surface was very much real and very true. What he was presenting mainly was that we had been miseducated. And Malcolm wasn't the first one to say that. Carter G. Woodson was the first one to say that we had been miseducated. And Malcolm was questioning white authority, which was an exaggeration in our life. I've heard African Americans say, "Oh, we can't do that." It is perfectly a legal thing for any citizen to do. And they say, "We can't do that. You know, whitey won't let us do that." Well, we had an exaggerated picture of white authority in our lives. So Malcolm was very much standing upon rational grounds when he was addressing the condition in our lives that ugly America of the past was responsible for, and that we ourselves, the Uncle Tom leaders of black people, were also partly responsible for. And to conclude this, I want to mention the break between Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad that eventually led to his murder or to his assassination. That break came about at a time when the Nation of Islam had its strong emphasis on material development, business development, and the Nation of Islam was attracting a new following, a new, what Malcolm called the resolute young men, African-American men, black men, was attracting them, and they weren't being given the orientation, the religious orientation, as the members had been given that religious orientation in the time when the emphasis was on religion as a psychology for empowering the psyche of the black people. So because of that, here now you have men, some of them coming from SNCC, some of them coming from the Black Panthers, some of them coming from the Blackstone Rangers and other gangs. So you have a different makeup in these young men in the 60s. And they're listening to this teaching, this powerful teaching, and they're hearing the emphasis on material, on money. So eventually we had people that were unpredictable. We had people that would kill each other if they felt that this is what the authority over them wanted. If they felt that a captain in the Temple of Islam or a powerful minister in the Temple of Islam wanted a particular person dead, believe me, there was some in the membership to carry that out, to actually go and kill that person. There were persons in the membership who were capable of doing those things, actually killing anybody they thought the authority over them in the temple or in the Nation of Islam wanted dead. And I was about to say, and they did kill him. And I'm aware of not one killing, I'm aware of many killings. We know about Malcolm because he was so popular. But there were others who were killed too, not just Malcolm. Others who presented a threat, but not a threat as serious as the threat that Malcolm presented. Now, how did Malcolm, the friend, the dear friend, the man that Elijah Muhammad told us was the best minister he had ever had, how now did he lose that friendship with Elijah Muhammad? I'm going to try in just about 5 minutes or less to identify what I believe to be the trigger men in that assassination. Not by name, the influences, the forces. All of us know who they arrested. Those persons' names are known. But who was behind them? What was the real trigger behind the assassin who had the shotgun, who had the pistol? What was behind them? Number one, jealousy in the leadership of the Nation of Islam. Other ministers became jealous of Malcolm's popularity, and they began to go and falsely report to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad on Malcolm, falsely charging him. It was so many of them, and at times there were problems. Malcolm had made mistakes, but Malcolm made mistakes from day one. Anybody make mistakes, but he could come to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and he could discuss it with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad would advise him how to handle the thing and not make that same mistake again. And that worked very well, and they never became angry with each other. I've seen Malcolm and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad discussing some problem that Malcolm had presented, and they were never angry with each other. They would discuss the problem in a very sober way, in a very decent way, and nobody had any bad emotions. Both of them showed nothing but good emotions. Now, with there being an organized, a national organized effort to discredit Malcolm, here was the whisper that was going around. Malcolm has become bigger than the Honorable Elijah Muhammad in the news. Malcolm, the Nation of Islam now is not as big as Malcolm in the news. Something has to be done about that. The army has to take over. And the army, it was a new language. We never used such a language. We never called the militant like ROTC unit. We never called it the army, but now they're calling it the army. Say the army has to take over. At the time, I was a minister in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, assigned to that post by my father. And they were even attacking me, trying to discredit me too. But with Malcolm, They were charging that he had become bigger in the eyes of the American people, the public, than the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad. Feeding God of Elijah Muhammad all those lies, exaggerated truths about Malcolm, eventually weakened Elijah Muhammad's faith in Malcolm. It had its toll on him eventually, because many of the things that they had put together, Malcolm couldn't explain it or couldn't defend himself very well. And they were constantly bombarding the Honorable Elijah Muhammad with negative reports on Malcolm. So eventually it had its toll. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad started to suspect Malcolm. When Malcolm began to see that his teacher that he lifted up as the black Moses for all of us, to deliver us to freedom, to real freedom, out of slavery to the white man, when he saw, not physical slavery, mental slavery, and believe me, we have too many blacks who are still mental slaves in a white man's world. Malcolm said, how can I continue to preach for him and defend him while his staff is undermining me and he's allowing it? Then Malcolm in turn suspected Elijah Muhammad. So here now you got two people that used to be closer than anybody had ever been in the leadership of the Nation of Islam, driven apart, forced apart by an organized effort of the leadership of the Nation of Islam leaders, national leaders, to destroy that relationship, undermine that relationship, and drive them apart. They're having success. They have driven Malcolm away from Elijah Muhammad to suspect the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. They have driven the Honorable Elijah Muhammad away. They two are suspecting each other now, so they have accomplished their job. So that's one of the triggers. That's one of the triggers. Now, I do believe strongly that U.S. Intelligence Department sent people in, and they were able to convince us that they were real, genuine members. They were not. They were agents, are either trained to be agents inside of the leadership of the Nation of Islam. And I believe that they were working to take advantage of every weakness that we had in the leadership. If there was any moral weakness, they were told to exploit it, to take advantage of it, to feed that weakness, to make it bigger, to make it more damaging. If there were any jealousy between national figures, they were told to exploit that weakness, feed it, and make it even more dangerous. So I believe that the intelligence department was also a trigger. And lastly, certain leaders who didn't care anything for the intelligence department, anything else, but they felt threatened. They felt their turf threatened by Malcolm. I don't want to single out any of these persons. One was a very powerful man on the East Coast. They felt their turf threatened by Malcolm. They felt that they could realize much more for themselves if Malcolm was out of the way. And I do believe that all they wanted was a climate, a condition in the Nation of Islam that would permit them to act out their hatred, actually kill Malcolm, and get away with it. Say we did it for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, or we did it for the Nation of Islam. There were such persons. I know at least three persons like that. And either one of those persons, or all three of those persons, could have actually been the ones to actually hire or assign the mission to assassinate Malcolm. They could have actually been the ones to assign the mission to those persons that actually pulled the trigger, the shotgun trigger, the handguns trigger, the triggers. I want to conclude by saying that Spike Lee's movie on Malcolm, I think, was an excellent movie. But you just got a hint of what was the life of Malcolm and a little hint of who Elijah Muhammad was. Spike Lee caught Elijah Muhammad only in one of his moods, a very serious mood, thinking about the danger that some element posed to the Nation of Islam, some threat on the Nation of Islam. Just one of his moods. And believe me, he caught that mood so strong. And the Freeman, the actor, he acted that part so well. Now, I'm the son of my father. And I had to catch myself and remind myself I wasn't looking at my father. That's how well they did the part. But I want to repeat that was only one of his moods. My father was a humorous man. He was a militant man. He was more than anything else. He was a father type. He was always reminding black man that you have to be a decent husband. You have to be a decent father. You have to provide for your own family. You have to not be idle and get out and get yourself a job. Don't copy the white man's bad ways. Copy his strength. If you're going to copy him, copy only his goodness and his strength. He was a father figure more than he was anything else. In fact, I heard one of the popular African-American leaders, and I'll tell you who it was. He might acknowledge it. He might not. Reverend Jesse Jackson told me, he said, in private meetings, say, we often called your father, father. Say, we referred to him as by the name, the respect, that name of respect, father. So I conclude now and welcome anyone who would like to ask me a question. And I hope that I can answer your question. Is there anyone with a question now you'd like to ask? Yes. We appreciate you coming to the mic so that we all hear and I hear, and plus there's a recording going. We'd like to keep this because it's very valuable to us to know what's on your mind and how you see these problems too. Yes.
First, I would like to say assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
I would like to know, was your father, or do you have any part of the Nobuju Ali? And also, could you please explain the Yaqub theory?
Yes, just a moment. The last part, I heard the...
Could you please explain the Yaqub theory that your father taught?
The what area?
Yaqub theory, or...
Can you spell that term?
Y-U-K-U-B-S.
Yaqub? Yaqub?
Yes.
I got it. Okay. All right, thank you. Yes. When the unit called the FOI, Fruit of Islam, really was, like I say, an ROTC organization, was formed for military drill, to give us military drill. And that was in 1931. At that time, the minister wore the fez, the dark red fez, with the black tassel, and all the members of the FOI wore that fez. Ministers, officials, and FOI soldiers wore that fez. That fez was the same fez that the Honorable Nobuju Ali, who formed the Moorish Science Temple, had his men wearing. So when you see the two pictures, right away you think they're the same order or the same organization. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad did have admiration all of his life for Drew Ali and the Moorish Science Temple. And few of the members of the Moorish Science Temple, even in the early days, joined the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And they never completely gave up their own ideas, but they felt comfortable identifying with the Nation of Islam because they had a bigger movement for accomplishing things. So they kind of came together as co-workers while not really giving up their own thinking completely. That's the Nation of Islam members and members of the Moorish Science Temple. I have had this question presented to me before, and to my knowledge, well, I know my father never was a member of the Moorish Science Temple, but he did have a strong interest in joining at the time, same time when he met Farrar, the strength, the fauna, he had a strong interest. He was thinking about joining the Moorish Science Temple. He was aware of it. He was a dissatisfied black man, and he was looking for something other than what the white world offered him. There could have been some members of my family, my father's brothers and sisters, that did join the Moorish Science Temple. That's possible. But we have no evidence at all. The evidence really is strongly saying that Honorable Elijah Muhammad was never himself a Moorish American, but Farrar copied Drew Ali's, image, the image that the Honorable Noble Drew Ali created for black people. Farrar copied it somewhat. He copied that image somewhat. And Drew Ali used religious science and symbols. Farrar took that from him. Farrar borrowed from many. He borrowed mainly from Marcus Garvey's idea for nationhood, and Booker T. Washington's idea for training the mind, and Noble Drew Ali's idea for giving our people a new religion, He borrowed from all of them. He was a master at what he did. Farrar himself, very, very shrewd man, powerful in religious science or religious psychology. Yes, so I hope I answered that first part of that question. I told that we don't have to rush, so that's why I took that much time. And now for the second part of your question, Yaqub. Yaqub in Arabic means Jacob. And Jacob in the Bible, before he became Israel, God gave him the name Israel, but he gave him the name Israel in the latter part of his life. In the early part of his life, when he was called Jacob, Jacob was a very deceitful person, but his deceit had a good end. You know, like they say, sometimes means justify ends. Well, that's the type of figure Jacob was. He did things that appeared to be very low down, dirty. But his purpose was a good purpose. His aim was good. He wanted to see the world come to God. And in wanting to see the world come to God, he did some very, very deceitful things. It begins with him. Yeah, that's that bell. Let me wait. It begins with him deceiving his own brother, Esau. And Esau's color was reddish, dark. And he was hairy. So he was hairy man. The Bible says of Jacob, says his color was whitest, and he was smooth, no hair on his body. That was Jacob. And the Bible says that Jacob deceived his brother and tricked his brother out of his birthrights. And then he again worked a trick on his brother Esau and tricked his brother out of his inheritance. His brother was a worldly man. Jacob was a spiritual man. Jacob also did some other things. He went to a strange people's land, and he tricked the leadership out of their cattle. He deceived the leadership and got their cattle from them by a trick. So this was Jacob. So in our lessons that we got from the fauna Farrar, we are given another trickster who is tricking, but for a good purpose. He's supposed to be serving God. And he is called the creator or the maker of the white race, Yaqub. And that we're told that the white race did not always exist on earth. That there was a time when there was no white person on earth. But Yaqub, a big-headed black scientist, discovered a way to make a white people from the genes or the pigmentation of the black people. So he grafted, by some process, the lighter pigment of the black people until the lighter pigment was diluted to extreme and it was white. This is the theory. This is the myth or the theory that we were given. And at the same time, while he was grafting the white race on an island called Patmos in the Bible, in the Aegean Sea around Greece, the area, the territory of Greece, the nation we call Greece, all of this is a black myth to give us a sense of superiority in history, in knowledge of history, knowledge of the white man's origin. It's to make us think that we know more than the white man about his own beginning. So it's all to soup us up, to make us not be cowed or intimidated by a white man's world, but think ourselves superior to him. It's all psychology. That's what it's all for. But there's a lot of truth to this language about Yaqub, of Jacob usurping, undermining, supplanting, this is the language in the Bible, supplanting other people's culture to impose his culture upon them and eventually get himself into power and authority over them. So we were given it, that story that we find in the Bible, as a creation myth telling us how the white man was created, how he began, and that the black man, before he created the white man, he created the world we see now, that the black man was actually God, not God from some other God. He was God from himself. This is what we were taught. So I hope that was some light on the character we call Yaqub. Yes. Could you come to the mic? Yes, thank you. Okay. I saw her. I recognized her first. But okay, you go on. Please come on.
Why did you and Farrakhan go separate ways?
Again.
Why did you and Farrakhan go separate ways?
Why?
Yes, why?
We go separate ways?
Yes.
Who are the we now?
You and Farrakhan.
Why does Farrakhan and Wallace, myself, W. Dean Muhammad, go separate ways? Because he feels, I'm going to give you his language, that African Americans are not yet ready to be given Islam as it is, as it's understood in the international world of Muslims. There are 1 billion, about 300 million Muslims on this earth that know nothing about that religion that they have in Farrakhan's organization. But I have patience with Farrakhan. If he says that what he's doing is a strategy and he's waiting for our people to show that they're ready now to embrace Islam as it's embraced by all Muslims, I have patience with him. I'm waiting to see. I'm waiting to see what Farrakhan's strategy will produce. I know at the end of the road we'll all be together, dead or alive. And that's no threat. Natural causes will bring that about, not some assassin. Natural causes will bring that about. Eventually we will all be together in the end of the road. We'll all be together. And it won't be in myth. It'll be in reality. Be in what everybody, in practical, sound, rational thought and teachings. We're all going to meet together on those grounds one day. Yes.
I have three questions.
Yes.
What made you change your views on the white race?
What made you change?
Mm-hmm.
Has occurred?
What made you change your view?
What made myself?
Right.
What made me change? See, this acoustics here is for the person here to be heard clearly out there. But when you speak to me, it's difficult for me to... Yeah. What made me change my mind from the old Nation of Islam's way to where it is today with 1,300,000,000 Muslims? That's an excellent question. And believe me, if you say it, give that answer in the fewest words possible. My answer is my father and my mother They conditioned me to not to, to be satisfied with anything that bothered my good conscience. They did that. And my good conscience began to throw off stuff that it could no longer tolerate. And I had no way but to turn to the book that even my father said was correct. That's the book that all Muslims read on this earth, called the Quran, or the Quran, properly in Arabic, the Quranic Quran. I turned to that, and I got great help, and eventually, I came all the way.
Okay, my second question is, since the death of Elijah Muhammad, what do you all still follow the same rules, go by the same rules that he had?
Those who with me? In my association,
right.
Those in my association. No, no, we do not. Anything that is in conflict or go up or is in opposition to what is clearly given to us in our holy book, we reject it. But I can't say I'm not indebted, even morally and spiritually and religiously, to that time we call my time in the Nation of Islam. I'm indebted to it. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad told me, and my mother, under his leadership, taught me not to drink liquors, not to use drugs, not to be profane, vulgar, profane, to be decent, to be honest, to have a job and earn my income lawfully. They taught me all these things. They even taught me not to smoke. And I haven't smoked, never smoked. And in the international Muslim community of the world, you can smoke and you won't be singled out, hey, that's a sinner. They won't do that. But in the Nation of Islam, if you smoke, your loyalty to the Nation of Islam or your loyalty to Islam would be questioned. I never smoke. So if my father would come right now and if he would judge me by his own rules, he'd find me to be an excellent follower of his, even today. Whatever my father left us that's good, I say keep it and build on it. Don't give up anything that was good. Anything worked well for you in your life and you know it doesn't bother your good conscience, keep it. Honorable Elijah Muhammad wants us to be proud of ourselves. Honorable Elijah Muhammad wanted us to be proud of ourselves. He's here, he still wants that. He wanted us to be industrious. He wanted us to show aggressiveness in business. He wanted us to eventually become developers in our own neighborhood, not to be satisfied to have somebody else come build houses for ourselves. He wanted us to build the houses, wanted us to plan the businesses for our neighborhood. That's a great, big, aggressive, bold ambition, a bold imagination. I encourage us to keep that bold imagination until we realize that bold ambition. That's my way.
Okay, my last question is, this is probably a question for Malcolm X, but since you are a good friend of his, I haven't finished reading a book, but I read a chapter where he was getting married to Betty, and I always wondered why he seemed so not intimate with his wife. He was gone most of the time, and it seemed like he wasn't that close to his wife. I always wondered why he was kind of shy from women or something.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. I knew him very well, and he would often tell me, what can I do? He said, these sisters, they want you to stay home. I can't stay home. So I got to get out of here and work. I got to go places. And that's what he did. He was a traveling minister. He was a national figure, so he had to travel from city to city. He would be away from home, maybe a week, And when he comes back, he's just there for a brief moment. He has to get right back out on the road. So that was very hard on his wife, and it could have affected his wife. But I don't think Dr. Betty Shabazz would say that Malcolm wasn't faithful to her. He was faithful. He was faithful, and it hurted him that he had to be away from her. But he had to be away from her. And he was a shy person, but I don't think he was so shy that he couldn't satisfy his wife.
Thank you very
much. You're welcome.
Much.
Yes.
I would like to know, why did you change the spelling of your last name?
Why did I change?
The spelling of your last name.
Oh, another excellent question. Yes, she asked, why did I change the spelling of my last name? Muhammad, the popular spelling is M-U-H-A-M-M-A-D. I changed my spelling to the old spelling that you will find in old dictionaries, M-O-H-A-M-M-E-D. I did it for many reasons, but I think the main reason was, two of equal importance. One was that I wanted to say there's a new Muhammad on the scene. There's a new Muhammad. And he's not mad. He's not Muhammad, M-A-D. He's sober. That's one thing I wanted to say. I wanted to change it from madness to M-E-D, need, which means keeping the balance. but I did that very secretly, but I felt that I believe in psychological effect. I believe that it would have good psychological effect. It would make people say, well, who is this Muhammad? You see? It would help draw attention to me as being apart or away from the other Muhammad or the old Muhammad. Not my father, but the old teachings, the old mental makeup, the old mind, you see. And the other strong reason was this. I was given that spelling on my birth certificate. Right now, my birth certificate. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad had that spelling too for most of our life as Muslims. He changed it when he was advised by Professor Jamil Diab from Jerusalem. He advised him to change the spelling to M-U-H-A-M-M-A-D. He said it would be easier for your people to pronounce the name, because many of the members of the temple, they were having difficulty pronouncing the name Muhammad. So he asked that we have the phonetic spelling. That's phonetic. M-U-H-A-M-M-A-D is the phonetic spelling. I decided to go back to what's on my birth certificate, what's on my driver's license, what's on my father's driver's license until he died. His name was M-O. All of this can be verified. See, M-O-H-A-M-M-E-D on his driver's license. All our legal papers. I don't think some of my sisters and brothers ever changed the spelling on their legal papers. So I went back to it. But now I'm having the problem. Some people think my name is supposed to be pronounced Mohammed. They don't know that the phonetic pronunciation, M-U and the A-D at the end, is the correct pronunciation, Muhammad. So you pronounce my spelling also, Muhammad. No different in the pronunciation, Muhammad.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Yes.
Yes, I would like to know, do the Muslims of America believe in polygamy?
Polygamy?
Yes.
No. No, we are not permitted. The Muslims nowhere believe in polygamy. Polygamy means many wives. No Muslim believe in having many wives. But Muslims are entitled to have as many as four wives. Muslim men are entitled to have as many as four wives under very, very strict qualifications or strict conditions. Most of the Muslim men in the whole world have only one wife. I have had more than one wife, but I'm a one-wife person myself. And I'm at the age now where I don't think I would be inclined to try to manage two youthful wives, you see. But I've had the thought. I've dreamed about it at times. Yeah. So, most of the presidents or leaders of countries or kings or whatever that you see on television in the news, most of them have one wife. They can afford more than one wife, but more than one, but most of them have one wife. So monogamy is what you expect to find even in the Islamic society. Monogamy, one wife. But we are permitted to have more than one. And if you knew the conditions, I don't want to take up all your time. I don't know how much time we got left now, you know, so someone should tell me if we're going to stay too long. But if you knew the conditions, you would see that this religion is a very decent religion. There's nothing indecent about a man keeping a wife who that he loved, and now she's having mental problems, and he doesn't want to institutionalize her. He doesn't want her in an institution. Our religion permits him to keep that wife and to take on another wife, as long as he doesn't do any serious damage to the first wife. As many as four, he can take on as many as four. Sometimes there are business reasons why a man has got a lot of business, he's got a lot of money, he's having a lot of wealth, a lot of responsibility. He needs a wife as a business partner, and believe me, a good wife makes the best business partner. And you find businessmen who are real powerful and succeeding, it's because he got a powerful woman he can trust that he's also intimate with, believe me. Now I'm going to have to stop.
Yes.
We want to thank you, Mr. Mohammed.
You're welcome. Thank you.
For more on the ministry of Imam W. Dean Muhammad, call or write WDM Publications. Call 1-708-862-7733 or write Post Office Box 1944, Calumet City, Illinois 60409. Thanks for listening.